Gwen insisted on attorneys for everything. Booster tax issues, liability protection, contractor squabbles, labor disputes. For her attenuated divorce, 5 years of litigation, and $1 million settlement. Teddy kept shaking his head.
Haley has enough to handle now. She doesn't need Ron Wrigley peering over her shoulder, too.
She may need someone to protect her. There was a pause, Teddy staring down at the kitchen floor. Protect her from what? Katie said. That's ridiculous. Why?
Haley has her family,
Teddy interrupted, looking up at Gwen, her mouth just beginning to open.
She doesn't need any more protection than that.
Walking to her car, trying to unravel everything, Katie heard footsteps behind her, the skim-skim of espadrilles. It was Tina Belfour, sailing toward her, serving apron still on, the bright white of her perennial crisp Oxford shirt like a flag. Katie, she said, moving very close, in the way she liked to talk, a woman's woman, a southern expat, crinkle-eyed, always a flicker of a smile no matter what words came from her mouth. Did Haley say something to you? She was trying to. She seemed very upset. Katie paused. She seemed angry. Don't pay her any mind, Tina said, walking alongside Katie, even increasing their pace. The doctor gave her some pills, and she's not herself. I understand, Katie said as they arrived at her car. Give her my love, okay? Tina smiled, those white teeth, perfect and even, like the former beauty queen she was. You got it, hon. Driving home, radio loud, muffler scraping the pavement, Katie tried to shake it off, but there was no shaking it off. Everything had been so exaggerated, stretched like in a carnival mirror. That jagged mouth, those slit eyes, the heave of those swimmers' shoulders smeared against the smoked glass. Haley's muscled arms jerking, head knocking back as she tried to pull the door. It reminded Katie of the time her stepdad raged on the front lawn after her mother locked him out, howling and shouting for hours, chucking pebbles and gravel at all their windows, snagging the screens, running around looking for something, anything, larger to throw. And there was something else she'd never seen on Haley's face before. A kind of intensity that reminded her, in some small way, of Devon.
But, Dad,
Devon was saying, her voice high,
look at it!
Katie found them in the garage. Eric was standing outside his car, apparently back from the shop, leaning over Devon as she sat in the front seat, legs shaking. You picked her up from practice? Katie said to Eric. I told you she was getting a ride with the Hargrove girls. They both turned and faced her in the same moment, their matching gray eyes.
It's my hand again, Mom, Devon said, rising, holding her wrist. That same spot.
Okay, Katie said, head aching from garage smells, solvent or aerosol, the epoxy they used on the floors, the musky shrimp smell from Drew's science project. Let's go inside. Under the harsh glare of the kitchen light, the wrist looked pink and puffy, a doll's. Can you feel that? Katie rested her fingers gently on Devon's skin, hot to the touch.
It's not broken, Devon said. I know the difference.
Did you have your tiger paws on?
I told you, they make my wrists weaker.
But for the vault.
Mom, no,
she said, pulling her wrist away, holding it against her flat, hard chest. Looking at it made Katie feel extravagantly bosomy, fleshful, obscene.
I just need to ice it.
Dad thinks you've been overdoing it, too, Katie said, in case that might matter more. We both agreed.
What kind of box did they put him in?
Drew asked.
Ryan.
A nice one, Katie said, taking a breath. Help me set the table. Drew was the only one who'd asked about the funeral, wanting to know how deep they had to dig, and if it would be quiet down there, and if Ryan would like it even though he was dead. He likes it, sweetie. I'm sure of it. She grabbed the forks, pricking the heel of her hand. She was still wearing her black dress. It felt wet inside.
Like how beetles are?
Drew decided.
They make a hole in the wood and stay there.
From upstairs, she could hear Eric moving. From the basement, Devon.
Sometimes it's for years, all by themselves, Drew said. Do you think they get lonely?
Katie looked at him, half hidden behind the stack of dinner plates he carried. A rush of heat pushed under her eyes. The thing you try never to think about when you go to a funeral is the thing that's really happening, the body in the box going into the ground. But now with Drew there, his chin resting on the plates, looking at her gravely, talking more about beetles, all she could think of was Ryan Beck, in a box, in the ground, all alone. Everyone picked at the defrosted ziti except Devon, who held her wrist and sipped a green smoothie through a straw. Practice had been confused and unproductive again, she said. Everyone kept wondering about the funeral, talking about the mugshot of Ryan on the news.
And saying things about Haley. All kinds of things.
What things? Katie asked.
Was it about the police?
The police? Eric asked. What did you hear?
Devon shrugged.
I tried not to listen.
You shouldn't listen, Eric said, leaning back. Those girls, they can't help it, but they'll also distract you if they can.
The flexion. I could feel it, Devon said, staring at her wrist. There's no time to rest it before qualifiers.
I like Haley, Drew said. I feel bad for her.
We all do, Katie said, rubbing his hand.
But all she could think about was Haley's face behind the glass, Ryan's body in that box. Her head ached.
I wonder when it'll get back to normal,
Devon said, chin resting on the rim of the glass.
Soon, Eric said. Try to put it all out of your head.
It's only been 4 days, Katie said, looking at Eric. The Belfours are in mourning.
But they were talking over her, talking about Devon's heel drive and the new vaulting table. It all seemed impossible, the way they were just charging forward.
The vault's pitched too low, Eric said. I saw it right when I walked in. I'll talk to Bobby.
No, it was my fault, Devon said. There was just so much noise in the gym. Everyone talking, no one working. Dad, I can't get that double twist back on my Yurchenko.
Eric nodded, a stitch of worry over his brow.
Slow and low. I know.
The funeral was just today.
Katie tried again, louder, but only Drew seemed to be listening to her.
Mom,
he said, staring at her between the tines of his fork.
How come they didn't burn him? Ryan, I mean, like when Mrs. Wheeler from school died.
Something in Katie's chest contracted painfully, her fork dropping from her hand and clattering to the table.
Hey, everybody, Katie said. The funeral was very sad for everyone. For Ryan's mother, for Haley.
It was all very sad. That boy died just 4 days ago.
They all turned to look at her and at her fork in the center of the table. Drew reached over and retrieved her fork, handed it to her.
Katie,
Eric said. But before he could say more, Devon stood up, fingers ringed around her swollen wrist. The wrist looked bigger than ever. It looked alive, the pulsing throb of a fat heart.
It is really sad, Mom,
Devon said, backing away, her face pale and strained.
No one ever said it wasn't really sad.
I'll talk to her,
Eric said, crawling beside Katie in bed.
Practice is how she works through feelings.
And how do you work through feelings? Katie asked, pulling their bedspread back with a snap. He looked at her.
I'm sorry I wasn't there today.
Then adding,
And I'm sorry it was hard for you.
For me? She said. Funerals are pretty hard for everyone. And, you know, people were surprised you weren't there. He reached for her arm.
I should have been there.
And there was a pause, and she was so tired.
Okay,
she replied, because in the end, it was so easy to just surrender to it, to his handsomeness, his dedicated dadness, the depth of his feelings, which he seemed to wear all over that car-tanned face, in all the smile lines around his eyes.
Oh,
she added, her own voice sounding so small, girl-like.
Except Haley. I need to tell you about Haley. What about her? His fingers drifting down her sternum, his other hand on her hip.
She was upset.
Very upset.
Of course she was. God.
But no, I mean, she was angry, and she really, really wanted to talk to me.
Why would she want to talk to you?
He said, his fingers pressing on her pelvis.
I never found out, she said, looking down at his hand.
The weight of the day began sinking into her. Sinking her. She wanted to hold on, to talk about it, but it seemed too involved, too heavy and strange.
It's a hard time for everybody, he said,
and he seemed suddenly so far away on the bed, the warmth of his body gone, his voice so distant she could barely hear him. Sometime in the night, she opened her eyes. It was Drew standing in the doorway, in his shark PJs, the teeth that glowed.
Mom, Devin won't stop yelling.
What? She asked, pulling the bedspread up over her bare legs. Eric deep in post-beer stupor.
You're dreaming.
All Drew's dreams of Devin. Devin flying, jumping off the roof, riding his bike, sneaking into the garage and driving away in their cars like Batman. She'd meant to ask the doctor or someone about them, but then, drifting down the hallway, Drew leading the way, she heard it too. From the closed door, Devin's voice, a snarl of sounds, stutters, rasps.
She's just talking in her sleep, Katie whispered. Go back to bed.
Tapping lightly on Devin's door, she watched Drew slip back into his room, eyes still on her. There was no answer, so she opened the door. There was Devin, her comforter kicked off the bed, standing in the middle of the room, her head in her hands, red wrist blazing.
Devin!
Katie rushed toward her. Devin, wake up! Pulling her hands from her face, she stared at Katie, eyes burning.
He was standing there, she said, pointing to where Katie stood. Mom, it was Ryan.
No, Katie said, touching her arms, trying to soothe her.
You were dreaming. He was right there, where you are, she said, a soft moan. He looks so sad, Mom.
The skin on Katie's shoulders quilled.
You were having a dream, she said, trying to hug her.
But Devin's elbows kept jabbing, her body twisting.
Usually it's your brother with the crazy dreams.
It took several minutes for Katie to calm her, to guide her back to bed.
Are you sure he wasn't here?
Devin asked finally, voice softening, head sinking back into the center of her pillow.
I'm sure, honey. Ryan's gone. He's not coming back. I know. Is Dad sleeping?
She said, her hair tangled over her face, hiding her.
What?
Yes, Katie said.
Remember that song?
What?
At the tiki party last winter? The one you danced to. She's electric.
I danced to it?
And on the palm of her hand is a blister.
She sang, a lisping pearl, like when she was very small. But no, Katie couldn't remember it. Still, she brushed her hand through Devin's hair, and Devin let out the smallest sigh, like an ah, after seeing things had turned out okay after all.
Mom,
she said dreamily,
don't be mad at Dad. I think he's sad.
What? Katie said.
We're all sad, Devin said, aren't we?
Her hand pressed on Eric's back. She tried to settle herself. He'd never woken up, and the only sound now was his breathing. Hoarse and ragged. For a second, she thought she saw his lashes lift, the white of one eye looking at her. But she was wrong. Chapter 8
Mrs. Knox, it's Nurse Patty.
Who?
Nurse Patty from Carver Elementary.
What? Everything was moving slowly in her head, a night of bad dreams, of beetles boring through smoked glass. Of swimming pools coated with beetle shells. Devin. That nightmare. The way she was standing in the middle of her room seeing ghosts. Then the day had hurtled past. Eric had gone to work before dawn, leaving Katie with the school drop-off, a conference call with the printer, a design deadline at noon, four parents trying to reach Eric. Then just before 2 o'clock came the call from Nurse Patty saying Drew had a sore throat and needed to be picked up immediately. Looking at him now in the rearview mirror, his lips waxy and head lolling, Katie decided to drive straight to Dr. Kemper, who jabbed a swab down there and confirmed what she already knew. Strep.
"Mom," Drew said in the car after, "I think Devin made me sick. I dreamed she put rocks in my mouth."
The line at the pharmacy was long. A shouting man with a fistful of prescription bottles at the front, and behind him a woman scrambling on the floor to recover her phone's battery cover. A jumble of feet, a woolly roll of dust floating from under a towering vitamin display. The woman dropped to her hands and knees as the cover spun away. Finally, she collapsed in cross-legged defeat on the floor. That was when Katie noticed the gentle tilt of her jaw, the sleepy eyes, just like her son's.
"Mrs. Beck, Helen," Katie said. "Are you okay?"
She looked up at Katie, nodded. Katie helped her to her feet.
"Thank you,"
she said, crinkling her prescription bag between nervous fingers.
"I'm having a bad day."
"Here,"
Drew said, stepping forward, her sooty battery cover in his infected hands.
"Thank you, honey,"
she smiled, her eyes filling.
"A little gent."
First, Helen couldn't find her rental car, then she wasn't sure which way her hotel was.
"I thought you were staying with the Belfours." "I'm at the Days Inn now. I needed to get out of that house. It felt bad, all these whispered conversations. The police calling all the time."
"The police?"
"And I haven't been sleeping," Helen said, shaking her head. "I came to pick up my meds before I head over to the station again. Your daughter's Debbie, right?"
"Devin,"
Katie said, looking toward the car. Drew now belted into the back seat, his face chalk white. She was eager to get him home, but Helen hooked her hand around Katie's wrist.
"The police station?"
"Yeah.
You know, things finally seem to be coming up roses for him,"
she said, her face crumpling slightly in a way that made Katie ache.
"Well, carnations, at least."
"I'm so sorry, Helen. I guess I already said that."
He would always find the lonely person in every room and go talk to them. Make them feel special.
She looked at Katie, smiling faintly.
"I'm sure he did that for you."
"Everybody liked Ryan,"
Katie said. Finally, Helen found her car but not her keys, so Katie offered to drive her to the station a few blocks away. As Drew waited in the car, Katie walked Helen to the entrance, the precinct building so old that green-tinted lanterns still stood sentinel on either side. For a second, Helen just stood at the door. Then she took a deep breath.
"Thank you again, Katie."
Waving her phone, she added,
"And thank your sweet boy for me."
Behind her, a way-faced man nearly stumbled to hold the door open for Helen.
"Ma'am,"
he said, tipping his baseball cap as she walked past him.
"At your service."
"Did you see his hat?"
Drew asked squeakily when she returned to the car. He was watching the man stroll across the lot.
"No,"
Katie said, taking a breath and then turning the ignition.
"Don't hurt your throat."
"The orange cap he was wearing. It had two eyes on it, and one was droopy. It made his face look droopy."
"That's not very nice," Katie said.
"Sorry, Mom."
But she looked in the rearview mirror, watched the man amble toward the panel van. Something in the way he'd stood there holding the door, the way he'd rocked from foot to foot as Helen passed through, felt familiar. Like her uncle Don, who also rocked like that, back ruined by years of lifting drywall. He used to carry around sandwich bags filled with blue pills. One day he came to the house streaked with gray sweat and tore the TV out of the wall and stole the new rims off her mom's car. That was a long time ago. Sometimes it was like none of it ever happened.
"I'm sorry he's sick,"
Devin said, dragging the spare air mattress into the basement.
"But I can't be around it, Mom. You know I can't. Qualifiers are 36 days away."
"He's on antibiotics,"
Katie assured her.
"By tomorrow, he won't be contagious."
but Devin refused to share a bathroom or even a hallway with her brother.
Sometimes he licks his hands when he's nervous, Mom.
Instead, she disappeared into the basement, the treadmill vibrating through the ceiling, and no one seemed interested in dinner, Eric on the phone with booster after booster. Drew, tunneling into a narcoticized sleep, his mouth open, his comforter and pillow massed on top of him in that cave-like way he liked, the humidifier purring beside him.
Mom, he said as he drifted off, the shrimp are dying, or they're dead already. The science fair.
That's days away, honey.
Spray bottle in hand, Katie started by wiping down all the chair rails, the doorknobs and jams, her head humming with thoughts, so many none could take shape. At Devin's empty bedroom, she stood in the doorway, bleach stinging her fingers. It was always so quiet, so clean and pin-neat, so contained. Occasionally, Katie would see the bedrooms of other girls, pink zebra-striped, sparkly G-Y-M-N-A-S-T-I-C-S, lettering across purple padded memo boards, mounds of leotards swirled onto mama-san chairs. But Devin was different once again.
It isn't how I pictured it,
Kirsten Seifert said once when Katie found her sneaking a peek during a booster meeting downstairs.
I thought you must have covered the walls with gymnastics posters, inspirational quotes, seven-point creeds. She looked at Katie. I don't know what I thought.
Parents always wanted to know what they'd fed Devin as a child, if they'd ever tried homeschooling, if she'd ever been given hormones, and was she vaccinated. They always thought there was a code they could crack. They never understood that it was all Devin, just like the room, spare, almost puritanical. All her awards were in the family room, the special shelf Eric built for all the trophies, wooden dowel pegs beneath to hang all the medals and ribbons. In here, everything was simple. A small corkboard with a meticulously pinned printout, elite compulsory program rules revised, a desk wiped clean with a feather duster every night, file boxes with labels, everything labeled, algebra, history one, routine music, family photos. The quote taped to the side of her computer monitor. The only way to escape fear is to trample it beneath your feet. Her first grips looped in a ribbon and hanging on the wall. The only odd piece, that gaudy Leroy Neiman tiger poster from their old gym. The day they left Tumble Angels for Bell Stars, Eric had torn it from the wall and given it to her. Devin had always loved it. Its million colors teeming and frothing from its whiskers, shooting from its slanted eyes. Spraying from doorframe to baseboard, the air in the room misted with bleach, Katie heard a chirp. There on the floor was Devin's phone in its tidy plaid case. Leaning down, she picked it up. She didn't mean to look precisely, but she didn't see any reason why she shouldn't. Swiping her thumb across the screen, she saw the flare of the missed calls icon, the harsh red arrows. And then the same number, over and over again. Every 10 or 15 minutes for hours. Haley Belfour. Haley Belfour, Haley Belfour, Haley Belfour. She found Eric in the kitchen, halfway through the screen door to the backyard, deep in a phone conversation. She could tell from the way he spoke, earnest, enunciating, patient, that Gwen was on the other end.
First, competition fees. That's $80 per gymnast and $40 per level, per team. Then coaching fees at $100 per session, 64 cents per mile, for travel times four coaches, plus $30 for coach meals times four coaches. No, the bylaws require us to pay for meals, even for the skill coaches. Well, that's what we voted on.
She waited a minute, Devin's phone like a hot iron in her hand, but it was taking too long. Hurrying down the nubby carpeted steps into the basement, the chalky smell of the mats, the gust from the laundry room, the churn of the treadmill, she could feel Devin even before she saw her. The energy she held so tightly until she let it thunder forth, a soaring vault, an epic tumbling pass, a delirious aerial on the beam. At the foot of the stairs, Katie stopped, watching her daughter run, her face bone white under the gooseneck light looped around one of the posts.
Mom,
She looked up, surprised, hands reaching for her headphones.
What is it? Did something happen?
Has Haley been trying to call you?
Haley?
She said, eyes scanning the room quickly, the floor beneath her, her book bag. Looking for her phone, of course, a classic teenager move, but not one Katie was used to from Devon, who barely seemed to notice her phone other than to look at the tumble tally after meets. Who'd never been like the other girls Katie saw at Devon's school, with their glittered fingernails clawed over their phones, trapped in a constant storm of entanglements and betrayals. "Yes, Haley," she said, waving Devon's phone. "Several times."
"What? No?"
Slowly, Devon untangled her headphones from her ears, the cords caught, her fingers gently pulling them apart.
"You have my phone?"
"It was on your bed, flashing." The lie came easily.
"Oh, and you started looking through it?"
"No," Katie said, noticing something in Devon's expression, a sense of the breach. It was unfair to feel like an invader. She who sewed cotton gussets onto the crotch of Devon's competition leotards if they were cut too high for underwear. She who, like every gymnast mom, so acutely attuned to her daughter's body. Hands on her thighs, massaging a groin pull that sometimes she felt it was her own.
"I just saw the missed calls. That's not the point, Devon. Why is she calling you?" "I don't know. I didn't answer."
"You have no idea?" Katie wasn't sure why, but she didn't believe her.
"I guess she's sad and calling a bunch of people. Everyone said she was acting funny at the funeral." "I didn't answer. I don't want to say the wrong thing."
"I'm sure she'd appreciate whatever you had to say," Katie said. It made sense, her daughter's life so blessedly untouched by the loss of a grandparent or even a pet. By the time Katie was Devon's age, her uncle had died in a fall. Her mom had burned through two marriages. She'd moved 6 times.
"But you and she, you aren't close. Why you?"
"I don't know. She probably won't call again. There's lots of people who know her better than me, like you."
"What? I'm not close.
Devon, if she calls again, you tell me," Katie said. But Devon had already slid her headphones back on and started running again. Katie sat at the kitchen table, waiting for that morning's tarry coffee to heat. Gwen had finally released Eric, but now he was upstairs checking on Drew. The vinyl placemat bore the imprint of Eric's jottings, the ballpoint pressed so hard. Rows and rows of numbers, mysterious hieroglyphics, Eric's perpetual vault table doodle, and something that had been crossed out vigorously over and over again. She held it up to the light without knowing why. All she could see was a doodle, a pair of slanty eyes, a V between them, like a cartoon owl.
"Poor kid. His throat looked like a slab of raw beef."
Eric's voice startled her, her hand dropping the placemat quickly, face flushing.
"What are you doing?"
What had she been doing? Before she could answer, Eric's phone lit up once more. They both looked down and saw the name. Gwen. Exchanged looks.
"Not a chance," Eric said, hands in the air.
The phone stopped, but seconds later, Katie's leaped to life.
"Gwen." "It might be important,"
Eric said gently. "Things are happening here. Did you know Haley's been calling our daughter over and over?"
"What?"
he said, his face very still. They both watched as the phone finally stopped. Then the text message came. "There's a witness."
"Gwen, it's really late," Eric said into the phone.
"Put her on speaker," Katie whispered. He set the phone down and Gwen's voice filled the kitchen. "Somebody saw the car, a trucker. Apparently he called the day after the accident, but he'd been on the road. He finally showed up at the station yesterday to make a statement. He didn't see it happen, but he saw a car speeding past up by the highway just before the turnoff to Ash Road."
"So, have they found the driver?"
Eric asked, standing up and walking to the sink. "No, but the guy said it was a woman. He didn't get a good look at her, but she was driving very fast, like she had some place she needed to be."
"Gwen, how do you know all this?"
Katie asked. "You don't own 6 restaurants and 10 parking lots in a town as small as this without having friends at the district attorney's office." Well, Katie said, for the Belfors' sake, I hope this leads to something.
But here's the kicker, Gwen said, the speaker crackling as her voice rose. He said the car was purple.
Katie looked at Eric, who turned around slowly, eyes on the phone.
Haley? He mouthed.
No way, Katie said, looking at him and then looking at the phone.
No, Gwen. I'm sure there are other purple cars, Gwen said, her voice breathier now, like she was right there in the room with them, her excitement palpable. We shouldn't jump to any conclusions.
They couldn't find anything on the internet except the news article from the day before. It doesn't make any sense, Katie said. 5 days later, he suddenly remembers this?
Gwen said he called the next day,
Eric reminded her. His eyes were on the screen, the photo of a spotlit ash road, the crimped guardrail, the dark earth massy below.
The police called Haley in for more questions, Katie said. Aunt Helen, I dropped her off at the police station.
She's not staying with the Belfors anymore.
Well, he said, I guess we know why.
You don't believe this, do you? Katie said.
Because some guy says he saw a purple car near Ash Road that night? It has to be Haley? And so she must have run over her own boyfriend?
The words themselves seemed to startle them both. He looked at her.
No, he said softly. I don't believe it.
She told him about the missed calls on Devon's phone and tried again to explain about Haley after the funeral. Haley through the sliding glass door. She tried to tell him, but it all felt cryptic, the whisper of a story rather than a story.
She kept pounding on the door, Katie said. She told me she knew what was happening.
Knew what was happening? Eric asked, leaning forward.
I don't know.
Katie, I think we need to keep out of all this, Eric said. This is something Teddy has to deal with. It's not our business. Our business is Devon.
Our business is Devon. She knew what he meant, but it reminded her of something one of Devon's schoolteachers once said to her. You may be in the Devon Knox business, but I'm in the education business.
She's under so much pressure right now, he said, his face strained and weary.
She thought, as she had many times, of how it must feel for Devon.
Everyone's hopes pinned to her, the gym's reputation waiting for her burnishing, the Gazette calling her the town's brightest star. How heavy it must feel, all the time.
But there was something in Eric's eyes, a jittery urgency.
Molly told me she was struggling with her Yurchenko again. A few months ago she was nearing the Amanar, now she can't even get her second twist. Amelie said she looked disoriented in the air. Devon told her she just got lost up there.
The words scissored through her.
That's how necks get broken, Teddy always said.
She couldn't help but think of Devon's first accident, the thump of the mower.
Maybe she shouldn't be practicing at all, Katie said. Not until things settle down.
She needs practice. It's what grounds her, he said. It's just that gym. Right now, it's not the safe place it used to be.
Okay, but if the gym isn't a good place, maybe we should just...
We need to keep her out of all of this,
Eric interrupted, so loud Katie flinched.
Yes, she said tightly.
That's what I'm trying to do. He looked at her. I know you are.
Arm darting, he reached for her hand, but she pulled it back without knowing why.
I'm sorry, she said, returning her hand to his. You surprised me.
Chapter 9
Mom!
The nicotine-grated voice of a 50-year-old pack-a-day woman.
Mom! Mom!
2:45, the clock read. Scrambling down the hall, her feet catching on a humidifier cord, a stray tennis shoe. Drew's room was unbearably hot, his glass of water untouched, film around its rim.
Honey, she said, what is it? What do you need?
Devon jumped off the roof.
What?
What?
Sitting straight up in bed, he looked at her, face red as a candy fireball.
She had wings, white wings, like a gypsy moth.
Oh, honey, you're dreaming again.
She looked inside his throat, scarlet and pulsing, webbed white. It did look like beef, she thought, with thick striations.
She jumped off the roof and into the car. Then she drove away.
Oh, honey.
And you?
He said, pupils widening, boring right through her.
You had scales all over your eyes like a snake.
Lie back down, she said. Try to rest. You and Devin, your crazy dreams. His hands on hers, sticky and hot.
Mom,
he said,
you can't go anywhere.
I'm not going anywhere, she said, hand to his face.
You'll miss everything,
he said.
Mom, you'll miss what's happening.
Just after 5, she felt Eric's body lift from the mattress. For a second, she forgot about everything that had happened in recent days and just watched him in the blue morning light. Watched that familiar span of shoulders, the way his hair curled up his neck, his hand there, that early morning piano key dance he did with his fingers, prodding at kinks from days spent leaning over the soundboard or toward the glaring computer screens. Watched him walk across the room, rolling his shoulders, yawning. Watched him emerge from the bathroom, the shower's fog, the smell of soap and shaving cream shuddering from him as he moved. Watched as he took his phone from the dresser, the steady thrum of texts, emails rippling from it, his head curled down, reading them, all of them under his fingertips. There were furtive thoughts she tried never to linger over. Like maybe Eric never would have married her if she hadn't gotten pregnant. The night it happened, drunk on a softball victory, the company team, the 3 jubilant hours at Rizzo's Tavern with everyone toasting his grand slam, Eric had been the one sweet-talking her into the back of the Soundmaster's van. The one who promised her it would be okay, promised her everything. Or the other thought, that he never would have stayed married to her if it weren't for Devin. It's just, he'd said once, that shaky first year, Devin swaddled to Katie's chest. I don't need you the same way. But thank God everything was different later and had been ever since. Before he left, that kiss on her cheek, his breath tanged with mouthwash. She loved him so much. Then the last week, sharp need its way back into her brain. The shower still warm, she stood under the water a long time. Everything was beautiful and nothing hurt. The sentence came to her, dizzy from the steam. What was that thing Teddy always said during practice?
Don't let me see it hurt. Everything's beautiful, nothing hurts.
Dreams and waking, mingling all night. Purple cars and way-faced strangers, and poor Ryan slipping into her half-conscious state. She felt like she hadn't slept at all. He would always find the lonely person in every room. That's when the memory came. A few months ago, Ryan in the gym's lobby, he'd caught her as she tried to change the bottle in the water cooler, the cold, wet thing slipping perilously from her arms like a wriggling child.
That's bigger than you are,
Ryan had said, reaching out for her, saving her. Rubbing her wrists, she watched him, forearms clamping the bottle, the cuts, scars, and puckered burns of a line cook. As he leaned over, turning the water bottle, she spotted a worn paperback gaping from his back pocket. It tumbled to the floor, resting on Katie's shoe. Picking it up, she touched the book's fading red cover, soft as felt.
I missed a lot in high school,
he said, screwing the glistening bottle into the stand.
I'm taking classes at JCC, making up for lost time.
She didn't know the book.
You shouldn't be lifting things like that,
he said, shaking his head. The bottle left his shirt front damp.
Maybe not, she said, her face warm and her hands still slippery. Now your daughter's another story, Ryan said. Small as a peanut. Strong as a tiger.
Oh, Katie said. Her shoulders slumped just a little.
Yes, yes she is.
He smiled, filling a cup of water for her, and it felt.
Of all the moms, he said, winking, you're the nicest.
Stepping from the shower, she heard the trill of her ringtone. The opening thumps of Assassin's Tango, a number she didn't know. Hello?
Mrs. Knox.
The voice was brittle and low, and she didn't recognize it. She wasn't even sure if it was male or female.
Why won't your daughter talk to me?
Who is this?
You can tell her for me that I know everything.
Haley, Katie said, just realizing it. Haley, what are you...
You can tell her I'm watching her. I know all about her. She can't hide from me.
Hey, calm down, Katie said, trying to keep in mind what Tina had said about her niece. All the medication.
I won't calm down, she said, that surly tone, clenched jaw. People have been telling me my whole life to calm down.
Haley, you're going through a lot right now.
I am, Mrs. Knox. I'm going through a lot, and thanks to that stunted freak daughter of yours, that little monkey.
A lurch in her chest, her voice rising. Don't you dare talk about...
I thought you were my friend.
Her voice hard, hammering.
I thought you were a decent person. Maybe you are, but I'm telling you this. You have no clue about that thing under your roof.
Jesus, Haley, what are you...
Your daughter's a fucking animal!
There was a click and silence. Seated on the edge of the bed, Katie stared at her feet on the bedroom carpet, trying to catch her breath, trying to control herself, fists clenched. There were all kinds of troubling ways grief could work on people, probing with hard fingers, scraping underneath old scars. Maybe Haley needed a focus, she told herself, a gathering point. Though why she had landed on Devon, Katie couldn't guess. Except she could. There were many things she'd had to get used to as Devon's mother. A competing gymnast calling her daughter Boulder Shoulders, Bitch Face, Ice Dyke. Or when that science teacher accused her of cheating.
No one who misses that much school could score this high on a test.
But those remarks were easy to dismiss. The anger fleeting, a hot wave that came over her and settled. Eric calming her, reminding her that some people would always be jealous of Devon, the way they were jealous of all beautiful and brilliant things. From Haley, though, it was different. Those words, the sharp thwack of them, they were words she'd never heard Haley use. It was like a Disney princess hurling foul epithets, oozing dirty talk. And the words made no sense. They seemed to spin from some far-off place and now latched hard in the center of her.
Mom?
Jolted. Katie looked up to see Devon in the doorway, showered, ponytail wet and sleek.
Why were you yelling?
Was I? She said.
Who was that on the phone? I thought I heard you say Haley.
No. Yes.
Why were you yelling at her?
Devon asked, her fingers running slow down her ponytail and landing at the bottom.
What did she want?
I don't know, Katie said. She wasn't making any sense. Everything felt backward. Katie was seated, still in her bathrobe, dripping all over the bedspread, as Devon loomed in the doorway, T-shirt straining over her muscled arms, questioning her. And Katie was lying.
Mom?
Devon said, eyes downcast.
What about the purple car that guy saw?
Katie looked at her, not sure what to say.
Who told you about the car?
Devon didn't say anything.
Did your dad tell you?
Devon paused, then shook her head.
Everyone knows. Everyone's texting about it.
Honey, she said, all we know for sure is that Haley's not herself right now.
Kind of like Grandma?
The last few visits with Katie's mom had spooked Devon. Once she forgot Devon's name and called her Marie, and then another time, which alarmed them all, she thought a leaf on the sidewalk was shrieking at her, accusing her of things.
It says I steal!
If she calls you again, Katie said, tell me right away.
She can't, Devon said. I blocked her.
Good, Devon.
Dad told me to.
This sensible, sensible girl. A girl who knew how to protect herself. Never a daredevil, never stunting without a safety mat, without spotters. A girl for whom instability was the ultimate enemy, who'd never known divorce or slamming doors or slamming fists. A girl whose home was a peaceful sanctum, even the basement padded. A life that had to be made safe because of the risks she put her body through. She was the most dangerous thing in her own life. Her body, the only dangerous thing.
Katie looked at her.
Of course he did.
When?
This morning before he left. He said to block her.
Teddy, I'm calling about Haley. She didn't even know what she was going to say, but she couldn't stop herself. The minute she dropped Devin off at school, she pressed the number.
Katie, dear,
answered Teddy, his voice gruff and creaky, wind whining in the background.
Don't listen to what you might hear, okay? Or read.
Teddy, this isn't about that eyewitness. It's Haley.
I can't talk now, he said. I'm waiting for Ron.
Ron Wrigley? The gym attorney?
I think that's him pulling up now.
There was a rustle, and then he hung up. All day the picture kept returning. The picture of Haley, as Katie had always known her. That thick mane of yellow hair pushed back as she grasped those tumbling 7-year-olds by the waist, guiding all their landings. That sunny, capable smile of hers. Each time the picture returned, it became stranger. To imagine a darkness at the center of that bright-lit, summer-skinned, effortless girl was very hard, but she'd seen it. The contorted face on the other side of the patio door. And now she'd heard it, too. Of all the girls she'd guessed to have a secret self inside, Haley would have been the last. Or close.
That's what you get for owning a purple car, Gwen said when she called Katie just before noon.
Katie could almost hear the tapping of her nails through the phone.
Not even Gwen seemed to know much. She knew Teddy had retained Ron Wrigley, that Haley was still cooperating with police, and that no other eyewitnesses had come forward.
There was an article in the Gazette about dozens of reports of damaged purple cars and suspicious paint and repair jobs coming in from across the county.
An unidentified man with a plum Toyota had been questioned, but released after it was determined that his torn bumper came from running over a dog. Another man claimed the new paint job on his Magenta Sentra was due to a rancid egging by a deranged ex.
"She called in the tip," he told the Gazette. "She thinks I stole her stereo and poisoned her cat. She wants to destroy me."
It was upsetting, like the seam of something had been torn ever so slightly. But the boosters were all focused on Haley.
The more you think about it, the weirder Haley's story is.
Calling during her lunch hour, Molly spoke breathily between what sounded like long tugs on a straw.
Ryan drives her home and leaves her car there? Why not drive himself home? And let me ask you this. Who walks 2 miles at 11 o'clock at night on that road? I hope they're testing for drugs.
Maybe Ryan had dealings that came back to haunt him, Kirsten Seifert whispered, calling Katie from the ladies' room at Bellstar's, her voice echoing high.
You saw that mugshot. Who knows what kind of life he led?
And there were other questions no one could get the answer to. What really happened between Haley and Ryan at that dinner? Were they engaged? No ring had been spotted on Haley's hand at the funeral. They were questions you couldn't ask anyone but Haley. And now, with Ron Wrigley on retainer, word was she wasn't talking to anyone. Except, Katie didn't really believe she would stay silent. The girls she'd heard on the phone that morning seemed unready for muzzling. She seemed to have so much to tell that her throat might burst. In the laundry room, the dryer knocking sneakers violently beside her, Katie loaded the washer with everything Drew had touched in the past 3 days. She almost didn't hear the phone. It was Eric, saying something had come up. He wouldn't be home for dinner. He'd explain later. And Devin was getting a ride home with the Chews, and he'd explain about that later, too.
Eric, I've been trying to call you all day. Haley called me.
What?
She told him about Haley's call, a version of it. She couldn't quite bring herself to use Haley's exact words. They were a blur anyway.
God, Eric said after a pause. She sounds completely unstable.
She wasn't herself. She was so angry. The thing she called Devin?
As she spoke, a thought fluttered in the back of her brain, something Haley had said.
You can tell her for me that I know everything.
Well, look at her history, Eric said, impatience edging into his voice. Her own mother couldn't handle her.
That was 10 years ago, Katie said.
She was a teenager. Didn't you do things when you were young that seem impossible now?
Maybe it's still in her, he said, not answering her question. Maybe that's why she was dating someone with a rap sheet.
Eric, she said, surprised. You know Ryan was a good kid. He was...
You're just like him.
That's what she thought she heard him say, the line crackling. What? What did you say?
You just liked him, he said.
Which was not the same, even remotely.
We all did. We all liked both of them, but we don't know what this is, do we? All we know is we don't want her bothering Devin again.
Katie didn't say anything for a moment, and she couldn't account for how upset she felt, her face hotly throbbing with it. I tried to talk to Teddy.
Don't talk to Teddy, he said. I'm going to talk to him. I don't want her calling us again.
Okay, Katie said.
And Katie, whatever you do, he said, don't tell Devin that Haley called.
Why not?
She has enough pressure. She doesn't need to know this.
The pause that followed felt very important. It was one of those moments in a marriage where you have to make a critical decision with alarming speed, and the consequences could last a long time, even forever. The words almost came out. I already told her. But they didn't.
Right, she said.
Whatever you say. The house felt small and sweaty and polluted. Devin came home, rubbing her hands with antibacterial cleanser. Hovering at her brother's door, she looked at Drew, asleep again, only his shuttered eyes visible above the swoop of the comforter. A cup of melting ice chips in her hand, Katie asked her how practice had gone.
He's so red,
she said.
Look at him.
He was, a little flame curling from beneath the covers. He's not contagious anymore. And Devin, backing away, nearly covering her face with her hand, hiding it.
Everyone's counting on me.
Chapter 10. Their tracksuits were shining in the night as they marched up the driveway.
Didn't you tell them about the strep? Katie asked, peeking through the curtain.
Eric nodded wearily.
They promised they wouldn't come inside.
It was after 10, and the boosters had arrived. Maybe it was all those arched backs, those manicured nails gripping water bottles, their glossy manes, the high whinnying sounds they made, their beady eyes. It reminded her of the hyenas in Drew's favorite animal book. They have excellent nighttime vision and hearing. True. They have powerful jaws and sharp teeth that they use to break open bones so they can feed. Also possibly true.
It's time to take matters into our own hands, Gwen was saying. Every day they don't practice, our girls descend into mediocrity. Our responsibility is to our kids and their performance at qualifiers, not this tabloid drama.
Katie watched them from the upstairs window. Drew, long asleep, Devin was holed up in her bedroom studying for an exam. Katie hoped she couldn't hear them. They were all arrayed on the patio. Gwen, Kirsten, Molly, with husband Jim in tow, gnawing on an energy bar as if he were straight off a run, the former college track star. And in the center now, Eric, always. She'd never really gotten used to it, to sharing him with all those antic mothers, their clicking heels and clucking heads and private confidences about their own homemade sorrows. Absent husband, nefarious sisters-in-law, Molly's breathless hugs. Breasts seeming to draw circles on Eric's chest. Kirsten's late-night calls whenever she opened the drambuie in the minibar on one of her business trips and wanted to settle in for a chat about the gym's future and Jordan's place in it. Becca Plonsky's birthday gifts, which this year included a pair of boxer shorts that read, "Boost this!" And Gwen. Always Gwen, who sometimes unclamped her talons at the booster parties, donning her sky-scraping snakeskin heels and singing Delta Dawn on karaoke after tequila shooters with Eric and Jim Chu. What Katie remembered, how she said that night, pounding on a tabletop, "Mark my goddamn words, Eric Knox, we will ride your daughter all the way to Olympic bronze, silver, and gold."
"Can I get anyone anything?"
Katie asked, finally stepping outside. Coffee? Vitamin C?
All their heads lifted, their bodies straining from their perches on the rusty lawn chairs, the same squeaky ones she'd meant to replace last summer. Gwen's had a center of fraying slats, tendrils ready to snap. Behind her sat her daughter, Lacey, hoodie hunched in a ball, her short, sinewy legs thick as banister knobs. And that face like a cartoon dog, soulful eyes and slight jowls, and the general aura of sorrow. But no one was listening to Katie, all eyes returning to Gwen's laptop, laid forth on the patio table like a holy book. A competition video played, the floor music score chirping, Katie diddying in the night air. "Lacey," Katie said, touching the girl's shoulder, sharp as an arrowhead, "would you like some juice?"
"Orange juice has 24 grams of sugar,"
Lacey replied, looking up, as if it had been a test and she was passing it. "John's done terrific work with those girls," Gwen interrupted. "But, entre nous, he is not happy. He's talked about opening a new gym, right over in Indian Springs."
"Who's John?" Katie asked, feeling Eric's eyes on her.
"John Ellers," Molly said. "At Empower."
Empower, an Olympic training gym 2 hours away in Hartswood, a woody, lush community near the water. The kind of place Katie and Eric had always dreamed of vacationing. Canoes, paddle boats, cracked crab on the water. Before the second mortgage and the most recent round of competition fees. And it was the place that in the past 5 years had propelled a half dozen girls to the national level. Girls who, rumor had it, still had their baby teeth at 12.
"Why are you talking about Empower?" Katie asked, moving closer.
"That's where they do daily weigh-ins. Girls work out with broken toes. At regionals, we saw an Empower girl compete with a leg brace."
And the thing Katie didn't say, that Empower parents paid $18,000 a year, which might be manageable for the banker, the married attorneys, the dominating business owner seated around her. But not for the Knoxes, with their debt and their sagging roof, and their creosote-lined chimney and the spidery foundation cracks their neighbor Mr. Watts kept pointing out, poking with a screwdriver and shaking his head. Gwen paused the video. Behind her, Lacey rocked nervously, her bare legs goose-prickled in the night air.
"Katie, we need to be prepared," Jim said. "All we have now are Teddy's skill coaches, minus the one possibly under suspicion by the police. And none of them are competition material."
"Teddy always hired from the heart, not the head,"
Molly sighed.
"Teddy hires from the wallet," Gwen said. "Why pay for a good tumbling coach when you can get your unstable, possibly criminal niece to do it for pin money?"
"Jesus,"
Katie said.
"You guys don't waste much time, do you?"
Looking over at Eric, waiting for him to join her.
"Teddy is focused on his family," Gwen said.
"And it's up to us to focus on ours."
"Without a high-level coach in place now, we don't achieve," Jim said, punching the words with military rigor. "Each day we lose before next month's qualifiers, we risk full collapse."
35 days,
Molly said, nodding vigorously.
"We have 3 girls going for junior elite, and I'm not just saying that because Cheyenne is one of them. But she is. And Devin, of course, for senior elite."
Everyone looked at Katie and Eric, both of whom crossed their arms.
"Forget Cheyenne. Forget our daughters,"
Gwen added more quietly, reaching down and smoothing Lacey's braids. She looked at Katie, eyes fixed.
"We know who this matters most for. Devin. She is our star. And we all know this may be her last chance."
Katie counted to 10 in her head. Several seconds of awkward quiet, Lacey digging energetically at the callus on her palm.
"Devin's ready," Eric said coolly. "She will be ready. She will be flawless, and she will dominate."
Katie looked at him, surprised. They never talked that way outside of the family, or even inside it. There'd never been any need to assert anything before the foot bobble 2 years ago. But all this reminded her of some of the chatter that had followed. That coach had skimped on equipment, failing to invest in good skill coaches. that he counted on the boosters to pick up the slack while he expanded his swimming pool, added the cedar deck, and the part that was only whispered, that Teddy might be squandering Devon's remarkable talent.